Well, good morning, church. Good morning, church. There we go. I want people at home to hear that. So there we go. Good. You know, happy Father's Day to dads out there, grandpas too. You know, that's what we get as fathers. We get to impact and influence our children and for generations to come. As dads, we get to embarrass our children. Tell my kids that all the time. As a dad, we get to just use the same jokes over and over again. And they love them. They want to hear them all the time. You know, it reminds me of a pastor and his young, new assistant pastor went to this pastor's conference. And as they're mingling about, one pastor from across the room yells out, 17! And all the pastors laugh. They're in the room. A minute later, another pastor yells out, 14. And again, all the pastors in the room, they break out with laughter. Another one shouts, 8. And again, every pastor laughs. And the new young pastor, he's kind of confused, and he asks the senior pastor, I don't get it. Why does one pastor yell out a number, everyone else in the room laugh? And the seasoned pastor says, well, you see, as pastors, we just recycle our jokes. And so we decided to take the top 25 illustrations and number them 1 to 25. And instead of saying the entire joke when we get together, we just yell out the illustration number and everyone else remembers the punchline and laughs. Young pastor says, okay, can I try? Sure, go ahead, the pastor answers. The young pastor yells out 12. There's complete silence. No one laughs. He tries again, 12. Still nothing. No response. Well, what happened? The new pastor asks. And the older pastor says, well, some people just don't know how to tell a good joke. Now, we smile at that. But you know what? There are triggers in life that prompt a response. You know what those are. There might be an event. There might be a word spoken that causes a strong reaction within us. Sometimes we go, where'd that come from? And the more on edge we are, like the times we are living in right now, do those triggers have the potential for even a greater reaction? What do we do with those strong reactions? Because the reaction itself is internal. It's not the problem. It's a question of response. Response. What will we choose as our response to the reaction that followed some trigger being pulled? You see, into every life are happenings, and many of those can be unpleasant. Well, can we embrace those circumstances in life as opportunities for God to do even a greater work? Alistair Begg says this. He says, we tend to assume that the circumstances have to be right if we're going to be effective Christians. But God is not waiting for the circumstances to be right. He is committed to producing really effective Christians even when the circumstances are wrong. Can you accept that? Can you embrace that? Well, we're looking at the book of Philippians, Galatians, Ephesians, Philippians, and it's all about choosing the right response. Choosing the right response. And we'll be picking it up today in chapter 1, verses 12 through 18. And so I invite you to turn there in your Bibles to Philippians chapter 1. Now, as you're turning there, I remind you of my approach to this study. I'm approaching this as a guide to joyful living. Now, Philippians is more than that, but thematically, joy is one thread that does run through it all. And the overarching principle for this entire series is that no one or nothing can rob us of our joy without our consent. No one or nothing can rob us of joy without our consent, even those triggers. And as we've seen so far, what Paul writes under the inspiration of God and the superintending of God is not like one attending a pity party in honor of himself. On the contrary, Paul was in prison and in chains. For him, the chains were links for the advancing of the gospel. And that's a clear passage of this section of scripture here, verses 12 through 18. The chains were links for the advancing of the gospel. The chains were links for the advancing of the gospel. Have you ever thought, this isn't what I had planned for my life? Ever felt that God has redirected your life through some circumstance and you have no idea why? Well, I want to speak to embracing, accepting God's purposes. I'm going to give you three principles. Three principles, because when we accept God's purposes, our first principle is we can remain optimistic even in the worst of circumstances. We can remain optimistic even in the worst of circumstances. All right, look with me. Philippians chapter 1, verse 12. Paul begins by saying, now I want you to know. I want to stop there. Now I want you to know. What is it that Paul wants them to know? Well, he doesn't want them to feel badly for him, and so he doesn't want them to know what life is like in prison. He doesn't want them to know when his trial date is set for. He chooses joy, and he will look to be positive here. Have you noticed all the negativity around us? I mean, it is challenging to stay positive in a negative world. It isn't always easy to find something positive. Like the son who brought home his report card, and the father looked at the card full of terrible, terrible grades, and he asked his son, well, what do you have to say about this? And the boy replied, well, at least you know I haven't been cheating. So he's finding the positive in his situation, probably to get out of the jam. But I ask you, how is negativity showing up in your life? Watch out for negativism breaking into your life. Sometimes we have to work hard at finding something positive. But you know, if we don't, we're negative, we're spreading that negativity. It's pretty contagious. Here is Paul's post. This is what his status would say. Verse 12. Now I want you to know, brothers, that what has happened to me has really served to advance the gospel. There's no negativism here. What has happened to me, he says. Well, what has happened to Paul? Well, in a mob scene in Jerusalem, Paul was beaten, and he would have been murdered if it weren't for the authorities that kind of stepped in and arrested him. He was brought to Caesarea to stand trial as a Roman citizen, and what was his charge? Just speaking for Christ. It was unjust, really. He was kept in confinement for over 2 years. Eventually, he was shipped out, literally, with other prisoners headed for Rome. And he never made it to Rome because the ship sank during a brutal storm, and Paul and other survivors buried it, and they were washed up on the shores of the island of Malta. It was on that island of Malta that Paul was then bitten by a snake. I mean, he can't catch a break. Actually, he did, because God healed him from the snake bite that would have killed him. He was then brought in chains to Rome, where he spent another 2 years in house arrest. That's a little what's behind the statement here, what has happened to me. But you notice there's not a trace of complaining or self-pity. He could remain optimistic even in the worst circumstances because his preoccupation was not with himself, but with the well-being of the church. He wanted them to be okay, and he was a calming presence because he was able to accept God's purposes and plans that were redirected. All of this, the beatings, the arrest, the shipwreck, the snake bite, the 4 years of confinement, were all seen by God, by Paul as what? Used by God to advance the gospel. So I asked, is that how you look at your circumstances in your life? Is that how I look at them? Can we see that all things against the backdrop of the gospel being advanced? Can we evaluate everything by kingdom priorities? It's all a matter of perspective. See, Paul is not only a joyful servant, he is an optimistic prisoner. And the reason for his optimism is that he could see that his imprisonment didn't halt the work of the gospel. It was actually advancing it. Now, the word advance there literally means to cut toward. And what it's saying is it was a word that was used to describe an army advance team hacking a path Through all the obstacles, through the dense trees and the underbrush, moving ahead slowly but with considerable effort. And as the soldiers moved forward, they'd have to clear away all the, cut through all the obstacles, open the roads, drain the swamps, build pontoon bridges so that the army could advance unhindered. That's the word. And Paul sees his imprisonment the same way. It may seem like a setback, and there's all kinds of obstacles there, but it actually resulted in the advancement of the gospel moving forward. He can see that there's progress in spite of opposition and trials, and that God has a better plan. Can you believe that? If you can, then you'll be able to choose joy. If you can't believe that, then you'll be overwhelmed with fear. See, we can either be negative in life and ask, why is this happening to me? Or be positive and ask, how might this result in something greater for God? And you know, all that's happening in our country right now, we can rightfully ask, how might this result in something greater for God? I don't know what that is. But might it be, might God's plan in all this that we're seeing have more to do with the Christian church than the nation? Might it be some refining that he's doing, that he wants to awaken the church and move us forward like never before, or at least not in anything recent past? What is God doing in these crazy times that just might advance the gospel? All right, staying optimistic, even the circumstances seem pretty negative. That's the first principle. Second principle, if we're to accept God's plans, we can be released from ministry even when we feel chained. We can be released from ministry even when we feel chained. All right, we are now given some evidence of the advancement of the gospel that Paul just spoke about in verse 12. And the first evidence is found in verse 13. It's the gospel is advancing among his captors. The gospel is advancing among his captors. He says in verse 13, as a result, it has become clear throughout the whole palace guard and to everyone else that I am in chains for Christ. Now, here's the setting. Paul is serving a prison sentence in Rome and most likely in the custody of the Praetorian Guard. Well, who's the Praetorian Guard? Well, they are the elite troops housed in Caesar's palace. These guys, they were specialized and they were handpicked. They were a military group. They were strong. They were courageous. They were intimidating. They were young men. They served in the palace guard, protecting Caesar and guarding the prisoners. Now, how would these Praetorian guards, who were one of the most important groups in ancient Rome at that time, be won over for the gospel? Are they going to show up to a bring a friend to church Sunday? I doubt it. If Paul held a tent meeting in the park, is he going to reach these guys? I mean, would they really want to show up to listen to this Jewish man from Tarsus tell them about Jesus? Not going to happen. God had a better idea. He would have this very prominent man, the Apostle Paul, be unjustly arrested, sent to Rome, where he'd be chained to a member of the Praetorian Guard 24 hours a day. And since they changed guards every 6 hours, this meant Paul would have another audience, or at least repeats of some of those guards, four times a day, 28 times a week, over 2,900 times in 2 years. And now you talk about a captive audience. See, Paul wasn't chained to them. They were chained to him. And I can't help but think of a man named Everett. Everett came to know the Lord late in life, and he has since gone to be with the Lord. And he was in the church I pastored in Portland, Maine. And Everett, he loved the Lord. But he was a little rough around the edges. But everywhere he went, he would share the gospel. I mean, if you happen to stand in front of him at Shaw's, he's telling you about Jesus. Now, his way of evangelizing was to go around and pick up hitchhikers. Hitchhiking was a big thing in that time in the Portland area. And so Everett made it his mission to drive around, Find a hitchhiker, stop, and give that person a ride. Now, I'm not recommending his method of evangelism, okay? But he would go, he'd pick these people up, and from the moment they got in the car, he would tell them about God's love for them and the gift of salvation. Why not, he would reply to my questioning his method. They are a captive audience. Now, I figured some of them probably shortened their trip, said, you know, I'm getting out right here. This is good. Now, I mentioned Everett. Not only because his passion to share the gospel was absolutely contagious, but because Everett had a tough upbringing, he had zero Bible training, he messed up his first marriage, he was estranged from a couple of his adult children, he lived presently with a wife who didn't want anything to do with the Lord, Everett had cancer, and yet he chose not to be chained to his circumstances. It did not stop him from sharing about his relationship with Jesus Christ. Now, Paul is in chains. That did not stop him from sharing about Christ to these guards. And if you wanted to influence the Roman Empire, you couldn't pick a better group to start with. And that's why we hear Paul say, what's happened to me has really served to advance the gospel. It has been clear throughout the whole palace guard and to everyone else that I am in chains for Christ. Now, at the end of this letter, by the way, in chapter 4 and verse 22, note this. It says, all the saints send you greetings. Now, get this. Especially those who belong to Caesar's household. Are you kidding me? He's talking about the conversion of some of these Praetorian guards. They came to Christ. Do you think God knows what he's doing? It was through Paul's suffering that lives were changed. Ask yourself, would I be willing to go through pain and suffering so that others might come to know Christ? And before you answer that, ask yourself this. Am I even willing presently to put up with a little inconvenience so that someone else might hear the gospel, that someone else might come to receive the gift of salvation? You see, sometimes we struggle, and I say myself included, we struggle to see the big picture when we're in the middle of a trial. Think advancement of the gospel. Consider that you might be going through that difficulty right now for the benefit of someone else. All right, do you feel chained to your circumstances right now? I mean, you might feel chained to a job you hate, but God has you in that job. You might feel chained to your financial situation. You might be chained to unemployment right now or chained to physical limitations or to restricted options. You may feel chained to your house with small children who need you, and you're just saying, you know, I'm just going to wait till I get on the other side of this season. Then I'm going to make a difference for Christ. What are the chains you feel are preventing you from advancing in your walk with the Lord? What do you believe to be confining to your witness for the Lord and service to Him? How might those chains be the links to greater ministry, greater influence, greater impact? Now, that's one evidence. The gospel is advancing through His captors. There's a second evidence of the advancement of the gospel, verse 14. The gospel's advancing through the church, Verse 14 says, because of my chains, most of the brothers in the Lord have been encouraged to speak the word of God more courageously and fearlessly. There's a fresh outbreak of evangelism going on because Paul's example put courage in them. Paul mentions their courage. And courage is the idea here of showing boldness in the face of danger or when you encounter a problem or an obstacle. It's to dare to face the challenge. That's courage. And you know what? That courage is contagious. Your courage can inspire another person to be bold in their walk with the Lord. Have you ever thought of it that way? Now, church, with all that's going on in the world, there's so much to debate and argue about and disagree on, but can we agree on this? Let's get on with the gospel. Let's get on with the gospel. Frankly, we're spending too much time and too much energy trying to change circumstances and people's viewpoints, but those things are not the deal. Get on speaking the word of God. Get on with the gospel. That is what really matters. See, we can look at our times and conclude these are the worst of times, or we can look at our situation and declare, great, these are the best of times. People need the Lord. All right, we need to accept God's plans and purposes. It releases us from ministry. Helps us to stay optimistic when things are negative around us. Thirdly, if we accept God's plans and purposes, we can rejoice in the message even when the messenger is faulty. We can rejoice in the message even when the messenger is faulty. Paul's chains not only stirred some to be more bold, it also stirred up some to be troublemakers. Look with me at verse 15. He says, it is true that some preach Christ out of envy and rivalry, but others out of goodwill. Now, who are these guys? Huh? I believe they're fellow Christians because they're preaching Christ. It wasn't a problem of their message, but their motives. And while Paul wasn't able to be out and about preaching for 2 years or more, there were those around who were taking advantage of the situation when Paul is down to gain some popularity for themselves, to build up their own reputation in little kingdoms. Now, believe it or not, church, this goes on in the Christian community. This rivalry stuff, this goes on among Christian leaders. The pastor's conference that I spoke about in my opening illustration can sometimes invite competitive conversations. Oh, how many people you got going to your church? Oh, I got this many. How about you? I got this many. How many baptisms you have this past year? Well, I have this many more than that. How many programs you have? It goes on. Believe me, it goes on. Paul here, he calls out their motivation. He speaks of their selfish ambition, which, by the way, is a term used for the wealthy, looking down on the common worker. He speaks of their rivalry, which is being competitive. And he speaks of their envy. And I just want to camp there with the envy for a second, because what is it that provokes us to attack other Christians, other Christian leaders? Well, sometimes it can come from envy. And the word, Greek word for envy here means to boil within. We're boiling up inside. We're just miserable. You all have to have one up on the other person. That's envy. The story is told of two businessmen who were bitter rivals. Their stores were across the street from each other, and they would spend their days keeping track of who had the most customers. One night, an angel appeared to one of the business owners and said, God will give you anything you ask for, but whatever you get, your competitor across the street will get twice as much. So if you ask for more customers, he will get twice as many. More wealth, he'll get twice as much wealth, and so on. The man thought for a moment and said, okay, my request is this, strike me blind in one eye. That's envy. That's envy. It can eat us up. It can make us miserable. And what triggers envy? Well, envy comes from the attitude of, I've been treated unfairly, and I want my fair share. And if I can't have it, you can't have your fair share either. That's envy. See, no one can be richer or healthier or happier or more spiritual or more gifted than we are. Envy is the great equalizer. It allows us to drag others down to the gutter where we live in our misery. That's envy. It was Irma Bombeck who said her prayer was this, Lord, if you cannot make me thin, at least make my friends look fat. Envy. How does envy show up? How does it show up in your life? Well, in our compliments, we like to add the word but. You know, they're really good at what they do, but they've had it kind of easy in life. See, envy shows up when we question other people's motives when they act in kindness toward us. Are you suffering from envy? Does it irritate you to hear others praised in your presence? We believe that someone else's success is because they got all the breaks. We secretly like it when that person of success falls. That's envy. And that's exactly what these preachers in Paul's day were doing. They were hoping to stir up trouble for Paul. It says in the middle of verse 17. Stir up trouble, which King James translated to add affliction to my bonds or to my chains. They are the epitome of the proverbial kicking a guy while he's down. They were being downright mean. Now, church, there is no place for meanness in the Christian community. And this was going to be a trigger. It'd be a trigger for you. When someone wants to hurt us, it triggers a reaction inside. What do we do with that? Strike back? Take to Twitter and speak kind of defense or throw some dirt on them? What would we want to do right here when these guys are trying to stir up trouble for Paul? How would Paul respond? Look at verse 18. He said, but what does it matter? I love that. What does it matter? Paul, how can you say it doesn't matter? Of course it matters. I don't think his motives are right. What does it matter? I think she's in it for show. What does it matter? I think he's all about boosting his own ego. What does it matter? I think she's in it for herself. What does it matter? But I think, listen, we're not to be the motive police. We are not in charge of others' motives. And when we get our eyes off of the messenger, who will be faulty, and onto the message, we can say like Paul, what does it matter? He continues, verse 18, what does it matter? The important thing is that in every way, whether from false motives or true, Christ is preached. Christ is preached. And because of this, he says, I rejoice. And just in case you missed it, he says, yes, and I will continue to rejoice. We can rejoice in the message even when the messenger is faulty. And Paul's not going to get all steamed about this. And for him, it's very personal. Now, if this was an issue of messing with the truth and the true gospel, Paul would have been all over it like white on rice, as we see in his letter to the churches in Galatia. And in no uncertain terms there, Paul calls them out. He uses his apostolic authority there. These men that Paul is referring to here were not preaching heresy. They were preaching for the wrong reasons. You see, it's possible to be doing something that is good, but our reasons for doing it are wrong. Paul is not going to chase that. He calls them out, but he's not going to chase it. Why not? Because Paul is so locked into the mission of advancing the gospel that he would not get sidetracked over motives. The messenger or the means by which God's good purpose is being fulfilled, even if it isn't to your liking, let it go. What does it matter? Now, think of the stuff that you got all hot and bothered about even this past week. How much of it really matters? Be honest with yourself here, because we can justify this. Everything matters. We want to die on every hill. Think about what got you all worked up. Does it really matter? There are just some things that are not worth the trouble and the energy. And in these times, honestly, in these times of political tension and national crisis, church, we need to stay on task. I'm not suggesting these issues are unimportant, but that we keep the main thing the main thing. And these words of God found in Philippians bring us around to what is to be central. D.A. Carson put it this way. He said, put the advance of the gospel at the center of your aspiration, our own comfort, our bruised feelings, our reputations, our misunderstood motives. All of these are insignificant in comparison with the advance of the gospel. Listen, fixing the political mess is not the deal. Our circumstances are not the deal. Straightening out others' viewpoints and methods are not the deal. The gospel is the deal. And for Paul, whether he was in chains or out of jail in freedom, whatever the situation, it was all about the gospel. It was all about preaching Christ. All of life for him, and ought to for us, revolves around this main thing. And you know what? That's where true joy is found. A lot of us run around pretty miserable and stressed out and frustrated. There's no joy in that. There was this farmer who went out hunting with his hound dog, and when the farmer returned, he still seemed very fresh, but the dog flopped down on the porch, just absolutely, totally exhausted. Someone there asked the farmer, what was wrong with this dog? Why he seemed so exhausted? And the farmer answered, Well, it wasn't the walking. We only covered 4 or 5 miles. But there wasn't a gate open along the way that the dog didn't go in and examine the whole field, ran all over the place. Not a cat appeared, but they had to go and chase it, and rabbits too. And there wasn't a dog that barked, but that he wore himself barking back and showing fight. And he's running all over the place. He must have gone 15 miles to my 5. No, it wasn't the route that got him, but the zigzagging. I suggest to you that the evangelical church today is doing a lot of zigzagging and has left us exhausted. There are many issues that cry for our attention, and they are important issues. But let's not get sidetracked by becoming so passionate about these issues that we have forgotten the main thing. Preach Christ. Preach Christ.